session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all for our sitting from September 2003 to June 2004. And we have a new court with a new justice. And let me introduce the new court to you. Starting on my far left is our new justice, Justice Patience Robensack, whom not only does the state of Wisconsin welcome, but so does the court, joining for a welcome this morning. And Justice Robensack has been sworn in and has taken the oath, and her oath is on file, isn't it? And she will have a formal investiture on Friday, September 12th, in the Assembly Chambers, and you are all welcome. I've introduced our newest justice, so I'll continue down the line, and I will carefully look at each justice because they're sitting in a position that I'm not accustomed to. And this is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. The vacant chair today will be occupied by Justice John Wilcox, but he's not participating in the first case, nor am I, so he's not sitting at the moment. And to the right of the vacant chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Now that you have met all of us, I want to welcome today Oregon High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. The Oregon High School students are with us with the Court with Class program, which is a national prize-winning program sponsored by the court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite high school students from around the state to join us on an oral argument. They have received briefs and other materials about the case, and will meet with a justice at noon to discuss the procedures of the Supreme Court. You are all welcome to join them for that noon presentation. And today, the justice is Justice David Prosser, with whom the class will meet. With all of that said, the first case will be called, as I told you, neither I nor Justice Wilcox is sitting and presiding for the first time is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. How quickly we rise up the ranks.
Like cream, we rise to the top, Chief. Thank you, and I'll call the first case, American Family Mutual Insurance Company versus The Pleasant Company et al. Versus West American Insurance Company et al. File number 011871. Our information is that the oral argument this morning will be divided in this fashion: 10 minutes by Paul Schwarzenbart, 15 minutes Michael Laskus, 20 minutes Wayne Yankala, 5 minutes Michael Lawrink, 5 minutes Leanne Conta, and rebuttal Paul Schwarzenbart, 5 minutes. Is that your understanding, counsel, of how we are going to proceed? I assume it is, since I don't hear anything to the contrary. And then, Mr. Schwarzenbart, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor has correctly recited the order of argument here today, as I understand it. May it please the Court, Paul Schwarzenbart of Madison, appearing on behalf of the Rentschler Company, along with Attorney Robert Kay. We will be sharing argument this morning on the petitioner's side with Attorney Mike Laskus, who represents the Pleasant Company. The issue before the court today involves a construction claim and the insurance coverage for that. At stake is whether the Rentschler Company, as the general contractor for construction of a building owned by the Pleasant Company, has liability insurance for its potential legal obligation to pay the owner for property damage to the building caused by the negligence of Rentschler's subcontractor, Clifford Lawson. In this case, as in any case, addressing insurance coverage and understanding of the facts giving rise to the claim is critical. I know those are summarized in the brief, but I'd like to emphasize some of them very briefly. This building project was completed in August of 1994, and the building was occupied by the owner at that time. In March of 1995, unusual building settlement was first noted, and over the next 4 or 5 years, that unusual building settlement continued and eventually resulted in extensive structural damage to the facility, which necessitated reconstruction, de-erection, and partial reconstruction of the facility in late 1999 and early 2000. The facts in this case, Your Honors, I believe are undisputed, and they're set forth at length in the trial court's memorandum decision and order dated March 23 of 2001. Judge Albert's decision in that case, we've quoted freely from that in our brief. We submit in this case there's no dispute that it was Rentschler's subcontractor's negligence in performing soils analysis that in this case resulted in inadequate soil surcharging. The inadequate soil surcharging in turn caused unexpected and unintended and highly unusual building settlement. And third, that building settlement did cause physical damage, physical injury to the building. Why do Rentschler and Pleasant believe there is insurance coverage for the liability of Rentschler arising out of these events? In short, number one, Rentschler's potential legal obligation to pay damages to the owner for physical injury to the building falls within the scope of the insuring clause. Second, the contractual liability exclusion relied upon by the Court of Appeals in this case has no application to negate coverage in this context. Third, the business risk exclusion, which operates here for completed operations, also does not apply to negate coverage because under the 1986 edition of the CGL policy, there's an exception for where the damaged work or the work out of which the damage arises was performed on your behalf by a subcontractor. And then lastly, none of the other exclusions which have been cited by the insurers applies to negate coverage in this context.
Counsel, if I may.
Yes.
I would like to focus on the third of those points, that is the 1986 revision with regard to the completed operations. In one of the briefs, perhaps it was yours, the argument is advanced that there is completed operations coverage here, that premium has been paid for it. Where in the policy does the completed operations coverage, where is that set forth? Is that under the your work exclusion and the exception to that exclusion?
The operative provisions, Your Honor, are exclusion L to the policy, which is the exclusion for your work in the context of completed operations. In our appendix, that exclusion L is at page 153 of the appendix. This is one of the American Family policies, and that language states property damage to your work arising out of it or any part of it and included in the product's completed operations hazard. The next paragraph states this exclusion does not apply if the damage work or the work out of which the damage arises was performed on your behalf by a subcontractor.
What happened in 1986? You made reference to that as a watershed year. And I think it was in your brief and the brief of one of the amicus that addressed that.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Mr. Laskus addressed this at length also, and I think he's probably prepared at length to go more into the drafting history. But in substance, what happened was prior to the 1986 revisions to the CGL policy, there was a provision that could be purchased. It was optional, and it was called the broad form endorsement. And the broad form endorsement, which is discussed in some of the cases in the brief, had removed certain language providing an exclusion where work was performed, quote, unquote, on behalf of the insured by others. And many courts concluded that that intention of that broad form endorsement was intended to provide coverage for damages where the damage arose out of work performed by a subcontractor. That broad form endorsement was then modified in the 1986 revisions and put within this exception to the completed operations exclusion, and that's the watershed that occurred in 1986. And that's why we believe it's vital that the court, in looking at past cases involving coverage for construction claims, that there be careful attention paid to the pre-1986 policy cases and the post-1986 cases. Probably the best example of that is in the cases out of Minnesota, where there are some pre-86 cases that would suggest there may not be coverage for damage to the contractor's own work. But the post-1986 cases, and particularly the O'Shaughnessy case, which was relied upon by the Court of Appeals, and the Kelchthaler case, which we believe is indistinguishable from the facts here, the O'Shaughnessy case describes the drafting history of that 1986 CGL policy and explains why the insurance industry intended and believed that there would be coverage in this context where damage to the contractor's work, as it's defined in the policy again, and I think that's included in the policy definitions, again, in the appendix, where that damage to the work is caused by subcontractor negligence.
Counselor, could I direct your attention to addition to the contract 1185? It deals with additional insured owners, and it names the Strand Association and Pleasant Company. And in that addition to the policy, it has additional exclusions in addition to those that we've been discussing. And one of the exclusions, sub 4C, talks about property damage to your work. Does that section have any bearing on the coverage questions we're dealing with today? If so, why? And if so, why not?
I'm not offhand familiar with what the section of the policy the court's referring to. Is that part of the policy application, or is it an endorsement included?
It's an endorsement, and it's endorsement number 1185, which is noted on the declaration page and was one of the latter pages in one of the policies that you all provided to me. And since it's my custom to make a notebook, I can't tell you whose appendix it came out of, but it does say appendix page 123 on the copy I have before me, so it may have been from Pleasant rather than from Rentschler.
It's not in the appendix at that citation that I have, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the endorsement. This endorsement changes the policy. Please read it carefully. It lists additional insured as Strand, Inc. and the Pleasant Company. And it has an additional exclusion, which is the one I read to you, which deals with your work. So, you know, it seems to go to what we're talking about, and I guess I wondered if you thought that it did.
My answer to that, Your Honor, without having that piece of paper in front of me, is it's, unless it says that it's intended to modify the completed operations exclusion, I don't know that it would have any impact directly here. I think it's typical with many insurance policies in the construction industry that the owner will be named as an additional insured in order that it be protected against workers' compensation type claims and other bodily injury claims that occur during the course of construction. And that would be my guess that may be intended to address the issue where the building is being constructed rather than after it's completed and has been delivered to the to the owner.
Yeah, I think that this deals with a completed building, so perhaps between now and your rebuttal, you can find the page, and then we can talk about it more specifically. Thank you.
Is this on Appendix 123 of the Pleasant Company? Is this endorsement changes the policy with regard to additional insured owners, lessees, or contractors?
Yeah, that's the one I want him just to talk about a little bit.
I think Mr. Laskus may be highlighting that material, so perhaps he might be able to address it as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the arguments that's been raised here is that there was no occurrence, so we don't even have to get to the exclusions, and we've addressed that in our brief, but I'd like to make I see my 10 minutes are up, and I will turn it over to Mr. Laskus at this point.
Thank you, counsel.
I am Michael Laskus, and I represent the Pleasant Company, and I think that the justices are correct in focusing on the business risk exclusions. I think this case turns on one exclusion and one exception. The one exclusion says this insurance does not apply to property damage to your work arising out of it or any part of it and included in the product's completed operations hazard. So what does that say? Products completed operations hazard means the project's done and it's been taken over by the owner. It says, look, Mr. Contractor, we're not going to cover this claim if your defective work screws up this project after the project has been completed. But 26 words were added to that exclusion in 1986. This exclusion does not apply if the damaged work or the work out of which the damage arises was performed on your behalf by a subcontractor. They're not talking about so-called other work. They're talking about damaged work, referring back to the exclusion, property damage to your work. They're saying that you've got a defective work problem, a subcontractor caused it, it damaged the project, the damages arose after the project was completed, fell within the product's completed hazard, we're going to provide coverage. Now, how did this all happen? 1976, you couldn't get this coverage. The exclusion said, we're not going to pay for any defective work, whether it was performed by you or on your behalf, meaning by a subcontractor. The industry responded to customer demand for coverage for subcontractor defective work. So in 1976, they offered the broad form property insurance endorsement. And how they did this was they took the endorsement and they removed the words on your behalf of. So now if the defective work was performed by you, you did not have coverage, but if it was performed on your behalf, then you did have coverage. And why did the industry do this at the time? If you look at O'Shaughnessy, if you look at FireGuard, if you look at Maryland versus Reeder, it's not very hard to see. Number one, they were dealing with a limited number of claims. Projects where the project had already been completed, the contractor no longer had control of the site. Secondly, they were dealing with subcontractors. By definition, the contractor didn't have control over the work of the subcontractors. Thirdly, the insurance company was not releasing the subcontractor from ultimate responsibility for its defective work. If it decided to pay, if it paid the claim, it could go against the subcontractor. Now, you might say, well, the subcontractor has insurance. Remember, the subcontractor has the same policy. It's only going to cover damages he causes to other work. He's going to fall within the your work exception. He is not going to get coverage for damages he causes to his own work. The industry was comfortable in providing this coverage for these reasons, and they were very comfortable in receiving a premium for this this coverage that they were providing. So what
Mr.
happens?
Laskus, let me interrupt you for a minute before you go further on that line. It strikes me that this is really a dispute involving a contract, the contract between the Pleasant Company and Rensselaer. That being the case, why is the economic loss doctrine not applicable under these circumstances?
Because of the subcontractor exception, what the industry is saying, we will pay for a claim that arises in contract. We will pay.
Are you trying to get coverage through an exclusion and then through the exclusion to that exclusion?
No, Your Honor. I am showing you the history of the policy. When the policy was written, the industry recognized that the insuring clause is written very broadly. It covers any accident, including an accident involving a subcontractor whose defective work damages the project. For example, if the Rentschler building or the Pleasant building had not been remediated and collapsed, if it collapsed that night and fell in on itself, it's no less an accident than if it fell on a person or if it fell on a forklift truck that was in there. An accident has occurred, so you are within the insuring clause. You have physical damage to tangible property. The only way you get outside of the insuring clause is if an exclusion bars coverage. On its face, the completed operations exclusion would bar coverage, but it doesn't here because an exemption restores the coverage afforded by the insuring clause.
How is this case different than Wausau Tile?
Wausau Tile, they never really reached the insurance coverage issues. That was a case where they decided that you had an integrated product and you didn't have a tort claim against the party that manufactured it. The court said, well, it's undisputed, you don't have an occurrence here. The court didn't do any analysis, and it sounds like the parties didn't raise the issue. If the court had reached the issue, it sounds like that would have really fallen within the impaired property exclusion because the component manufactured by the manufacturer damaged other property, that is the tiles in which it was installed, and the damage to the tiles wouldn't be covered under the exclusion. But it never really reached the question. The court that reached the question was Kelchtheller, and going back to what happened in 1986, they add the exemption, and then some cases say, well, we don't think just removing the words on behalf of really was intended to bring in subcontractor coverage. So in 1986, they take the endorsement, they build it right into the policy, and then they add the words, this exclusion does not apply if the damaged work or the work out of which the damage arises was performed on your behalf by a subcontractor. Quite frankly, I think the insurance industry thought, I don't think we can write this much clearer other than to say, oh, do you really mean it? Yeah, we really mean it. We're trying to cover subcontractor defects caused, which caused damage to the project itself. So look at what happens in this case. American Family gets the case. They write a letter back and they say, well, you know, this might not be covered, but we do cover it if it was caused by a subcontractor. Then they pay $26,000 in damages of Rentschler in making initial repairs. And then they write a letter to Pleasant and they say, hey, we understand you're worried about this, but you've got coverage because this damage was caused by a subcontractor. Now, I know that they're not stopped by writing those letters. But what I will submit is that tells you that this industry knows what this language was intended to cover, and they know what this exemption says. And to argue that the insured did not reasonably expect to be covered under these circumstances, I think is a real stretch.
Well, how does then the endorsement that I asked Mr. Schwarzenbart about apply? And it's the endorsement 1185, and the exclusion I'm concerned about is a statement saying, additional exclusions, this insurance does not apply to subparent, foreparent property damage to subparent, C-parent, your work for the additional insured.
Your Honor, this deals with additional insureds Strand and Pleasant. Pleasant is an additional insured in the sense that if someone makes a claim against Pleasant and Pleasant is held liable and Rentschler has agreed to indemnify Pleasant, then there's going to be coverage for Pleasant. But they're saying we're not going to cover Pleasant, claim against Pleasant if it arose, I think, out of a product's completed operations risk.
So you're looking at it simply as a claim by a third party, not anything to do with the claims between the parties who are before the court.
What I'm looking at is the claim that Pleasant is making against Rentschler.
Right.
And Rentschler is not the insured. Rentschler is the insured and is not affected by this endorsement because this is naming Pleasant and Strand as the insured.
Okay. And so the work that we're talking about, your work here, if it were defective and if there were a claim, it would have to be a claim against Pleasant, not a claim against Rentschler.
To fall within this endorsement.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, the final point I would make on this point is that if If you look at the industry literature, this document was drafted by the Insurance Services Organization. It serves like 3,000 insurance companies, if you read the case law. And they promulgate circulars which explain why they make changes and what the purpose of that changes is. The National Underwriters Company also issues fire casualty and surety bulletins, which are well respected within the industry and which are quoted at length in many cases, including Kelchtheller. These are publications which are used by brokers, adjusters, and agents to sell insurance policies, interpret insurance policies, and adjust insurance policies. The International Risk Management Institute has 23,000 pages in print, according to its website, which indicate how these policies have evolved and what they're intended to cover. If you look at all of this literature, it is all totally consistent. Number one, on what the history of these provisions was. Number two, what the purpose of these provisions was. And number three, on how these provisions should be interpreted. If you look at Kelchtheller, they quote the National Underwriters Company at length, saying that, we'll give you an example. A electrical subcontractor does a poor job of wiring a building. The project is taken over by the owner. The building burns down. There is damage to the project, obviously. There is damage to the subcontractor's work. This clearly falls within the exception to the exclusion. There is coverage. If you look at the briefs submitted by the insurance companies, I think two things stand out. One is that none of them have indicated that there is any industry literature of any type which indicates that our interpretation of these policies is not true. Number two, they have not pointed to any single instance in which this exception will come into play. They are saying that this exception is mere surplusage, that it either is taken out by the definition of accident, which I think is a terrible stretch, to take that word, which is undefined in the policy, put their gloss on it, and ask this court to accept their interpretation of it, or they say it is taken out entirely by the assumed contractual liability exclusion, when the vast majority of courts have recognized that the assumed contractual liability exclusion has nothing to do with defective workmanship claims.
Well, I want to return to the economic loss doctrine. Are you suggesting that, first of all, it seems to me your position is the economic loss doctrine does not apply here. Am I right?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Your Honor.
Even if the economic loss doctrine does or could apply, is it your position that the parties to the insurance contract can provide coverage and get premium for coverage regardless of whether or not they could invoke the protection of the economic loss doctrine?
I think, to me, it's simple. An insurance company can cover a breach of contract. There is nothing in the law that precludes them from writing a policy that says if your subcontractor performs defective work and you're held liable in contract for it and it damages the project and it happened after the project was completed, that we're going to cover that. When they issue an E&O policy to a lawyer, they cover breach of contract. You can purchase subcontractor default insurance, as we noted in our brief. You can buy insurance that will not only cover workmanship defects that arise after the project is completed, but that cover them at any time, whether the damages arose before the contract was completed or after the project was completed. There is nothing in the law that precludes an insurance company from offering this coverage. And it would be particularly unfair if they offer the coverage, they take a premium for the coverage, but then they are not required to live up to the coverage, which I think is pretty clearly written into the policy.
Could I ask you to pinpoint exactly what the work was that the subcontractor did?
In this case, Rentschler was a design builder. So they had to design the project and build the project. In order to design the project, they had to do soil testing and they had to design a foundation for the project because it was on marshy soil. And I would submit to this court, a lot of builders have built projects on more difficult sites than this one. that part of their work was to do that design work. It's not much different than putting together a shop drawing or designing a shoring system. It's all part of the work. If you look at the definition of work in the policy itself, it's very broadly written to include the work or operations of the insured, whether performed by him or on his behalf, and it includes warranties of fitness, merchantability, etc. It's a very broad definition. It's somewhat parallel to the definition of work that's contained in the standard AIA contract itself, which is part of this. If you look at that definition of work, it includes everything that's necessary to accomplish the project. So that includes the design elements of the work and the actual construction elements of the work.
So all the counsel, all the advice, that's work. Or did they
yeah, it's all work. If Brentschler was required to provide advice on foundations, if Brentschler was required to design a foundation that would support the building, that's all part of Brentschler's work. And that's not only true in just the common sense way, it's true if you look at the actual definition of work in the policy.
What I'm really trying to get at is what was the subcontractor's work?
The subcontractor's work is Lawson was hired to do soil testing and to determine what kind of work had to be done to the site in order to ready it to support this building. And what Lawson did was say, oh, I'm sorry, my time is up.
You may finish.
What Lawson did was he came in, he tested the soils. He said, this is a tough site, but it'll support a typical metal frame building. But what you have to do is you have to bring in soil, put it on top, compress the site for a period of time. I need to run some tests. I'll tell you when this building is ready to go. And also what you need to do is you need to leave the fill 1 foot higher than the final elevation that you want for the building. And then the building will gradually compress itself down that 1 foot. Then the site will be ready, and you're not going to have this differential settlement. What happens is he makes some errors in his tests and in designing the techniques he's going to use. As a result, the site wasn't ready, and then after it was built, you started gradually to get this differential settlement. If it's settled uniformly, you don't have a problem, but you got differential settlement. Thank you.
What I'm trying to get at, sir, is that I have the impression that the subcontractor was simply advising, giving advice, telling Rentschler what to do, and then it was done by Rentschler. And are you saying that there's no distinction here?
There's no distinction. No, he did the testing, but the actual work was done by another subcontractor who had the equipment to move the dirt around.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Yankala?
May it please the Court. My name is Wayne Yankala, and I represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company in this case. The first thing I want to emphasize in my oral argument is that what this case is all about is a breach of contract claim. There is no tort claim that's being pursued by the Pleasant Company in this matter. And this breach of contract claim arises solely out of a special warranty that was included in the Pleasant Rentschler contract. In earlier contracts between the parties for other projects, there was no such warranty. Now, this particular warranty in this case, in essence, provided a guarantee to Pleasant Company that if this building settled, that Rentschler would replace that building and basically give them the benefit of their bargain. A building that would be constructed on a very poor site with very poor subsoil conditions, a building that had unusual floor levelness requirements, a building with all that taken into consideration would not settle excessively. And the parties, these are commercial parties, they negotiated for that provision. And that the court cannot lose track of that. We're dealing with a commercial situation. These parties appreciated the risk. Clifford Lawson identified the risk way back in 1991 during earlier projects and identified this particular location as a very problematic site. The parties knew that. They analyzed it. They allocated the risk between the parties. Rentschler accepted that risk.
Counselor, do you think that there was an occurrence under the terms of the policy?
I don't believe there was an occurrence.
Why not?
There was no occurrence because we have here solely a breach of contract claim. A breach of contract claim does not constitute an occurrence because it's not an accident. Under the law, a breach of contract claim has been deemed to be not fortuitous in the sense that it should constitute an accident. And it's because the parties to the contract appreciate the risks, and in this case, it's evident they did. This risk of the building settling was not something that was fortuitous. They knew that there was that potential there. In fact, Clifford Lawson in his report said, even if you do this, the surcharging work, this building's still going to settle. And you have to put up a building that's tolerant of settlement. They knew the building was going to settle. The question here was how much. And obviously they ran the risk that the building would not settle excessively, and that risk was a risk that was assumed by Rentschler, and obviously they didn't call that decision right because the building did settle excessively. Now, with respect to...
Counsel, I listened to the history of the completed operations endorsement, or the prior endorsement that became part of the CGL policy. I thought it was in 86, maybe it's 76, with regard to the completed operations. I note, as was advanced by counsel, that there's premium paid and collected for completed operations. Is it your position that in a situation where there is a construction contract that there never will be coverage for the subcontractor's error?
No. It's simply put, there's no coverage for a claim for economic damages, purely economic damages, which arise out of defective workmanship, which is the claim in this case.
Well, it seems to me your position is there is no – if there is a construction contract – and I need help on this – if there's a construction contract, there's no occurrence.
No. You can have a contractor performing work under a contract where the contractor's activities result in a tort. But we don't have that in this case. What we have is a contract to put up a building that doesn't settle with a special guarantee or warranty, and the building settles. We don't have a tort. We don't have damage to other property. And that brings into play completed operations coverage in the sense that you have to look at it to see whether we really have that triggered. And if you read it, what it provides is that there's coverage for property damage arising out of your work. Your work is a defined term. And as Attorney Laskus stated, your work in this context would include all this, the intellectual component, the materials, everything. Your work here was the building. The building did not cause damage in this case to any property. There was no physical injury to tangible property other than the work, your work itself, the building.
I want to take a look. What I'm focusing on is, of course, the subcontractor exclusion. The exclusion is exclusion L, property damage to your work arising out of it or any part of it, and include in the product's completed operation hazard. So that is an exclusion to coverage. But then this exception says this exclusion does not apply if the damaged work or the work out of which the damage arises was performed on your behalf by a subcontractor.
Is it your position, if there is no bodily injury involved, this provision does not come into play?
It's my position that an exception to an exclusion cannot create coverage. You have to look at the completed operations coverage to determine if this policy was intended to apply here. And the completed operations coverage only provides coverage to Rentschler if Rentschler's work, your work, a defined term, causes property damage. Property damage meaning physical injury to tangible property. We don't have that here. All that's claimed is the remediation costs, tearing this building down, rebuilding it, doing it right this time, and the consequential damages associated with that. And that has been, it's undisputed that the consequential damages in this case relate to the business disruption with the building being torn down, having to rent other space while the building is being reworked, and the costs associated with removing the pick towers and the conveyor system in the building as part of the remediation work. There's no damage to physical injury to tangible property in this case. The completed operations coverage does not come into play.
You started your argument with the completed operations contractual liability exclusion, perhaps more accurately stated. You started your argument with the contractual liability exclusion, as I understood your argument.
Yes. I would like to continue because I have a...
Is that your best argument? There are lots of arguments here. There are lots of exclusions and exceptions and doctrines. What's your strongest argument for not paying on this claim?
Well, I don't know if I could really rank them, but if I was personally analyzing this,
which one do you feel most like Clarence Darrow? When
I would. My decision would read that all that's involved in this case is a contract dispute between two parties. That we have a breach of contract claim. The economic loss doctrine limits any punitive tort claim that might be existing somewhere, and that we just have solely a breach of contract claim. Commercial general liability policies are not intended to cover breach of contract claims, and there's therefore no occurrence because it's strictly a breach of contract.
Okay, so
there's no damage to other property. It's strictly defective work.
My question is, which is your strongest one argument? And this time you let off with economic loss doctrine.
I think that is a strong argument, given the cases that this court, recent cases of this court and recent cases of other courts, applying the economic loss doctrine to real property. And applying it to...
This isn't a trick question. I just want you to choose, so that's the one I want to focus on. So which one should we focus on?
Well, you want me to rank. I think I would rank it economic loss doctrine, no occurrence, no accident.
Okay, let's
Number
go.
Two, I do think the contractual liability exclusion is strong. And I'd like to briefly explain that. We have Nelson. We have Meyer. Nelson is real broad. It stands for the... If you want to read it very broadly, it stands for the proposition that if you have a breach of contract claim, that exclusion is triggered. They really didn't focus on this liability assumed by contract portion of the exclusion. Now, Meyer, I think, was distinguishable. It doesn't deal with the same exclusion. It deals with a grant of coverage. It dealt with a workers' compensation context. I think we can just completely disregard that case from the standpoint of trying to harmonize the law. But as far as the contractual liability exclusion in this case, we don't have a scenario like the Nelson case where it's just so broad that it's breach of contract, therefore the exclusion is triggered. What we have here is a real assumption of liability. And the assumption of liability was by reason of the special warranty. That's what they call it in the contract, the special warranty. Now, by definition, a warranty is an agreement to indemnify the party you make the promise to if what you're promising does not prove to be a fact. That's the definition of warranty.
Excuse me, Counselor, how is it that you can say the warranty provision of the contract is something that's assumed by contract? Isn't it just something that's agreed to as any other contract provision is?
No, because in this particular agreement, it was a liability that Rentschler wouldn't have but for the fact that that special warranty was in the contract.
Well, he wouldn't have any of the liabilities under the contract but for the particular provisions which are claimed to have been breached, right?
That's precisely correct. So it was Rentschler that created their responsibility. They're in control. These are commercial parties.
I understand that. My concern goes more to the words that American Family used in the policy, where it says assumed under contract. That's an odd term for talking about a contractual provision that is within the contract that you're actually looking at. Usually you agree to terms in a contract. And generally when you assume a liability in a contract, it's a liability that's outside the four squares of the contract between the parties and relates to either some function by somebody else or something that's extrinsic to the contract. Wouldn't you agree?
No.
No.
I believe that a special warranty like this is by definition an agreement to indemnify, and by agreeing to indemnify Pleasant for anything that's wrong with this building, any defect, and any consequential damages, which was the what the special warranty provided, that is the assumption of liability. But for that special warranty, there would be no liability.
As I looked at Couch and Appleman, the treatises, and even Arnie Anderson is here today, his treatise, but Couch and Appleman on insurance, with regard to following up on Justice Rogenczak's questions, my recollection is the assumption of a contract was meant to be an assumption of liability, rather. It was meant to be a indemnification or hold harmless with regard to a third party. Do you disagree with that interpretation of that contract provision?
Yes, I do. And I think that if you read the entire exclusion, you'll see that what's accepted is various types of third-party indemnity contracts. In other words, the intent is that various types of third-party indemnity contracts, in fact, are not excluded. And if you had this blanket rule that it applies to any type of third-party indemnity contract, there'd be no reason for that exception to the exclusion.
You seem to be then pretty much foursquare with the Court of Appeals decision with regard to the contractual liability.
No.
Okay. Do you think the Court of Appeals got it wrong with regard to contractual liability?
I think they got it right, but I think it could have been better explained in the sense that, what I want to do is I want to point out this article that was recently cited by Rentschler's counsel in the International Risk Management Institute, and that was after the briefs were submitted. There was a recent letter that cited that article, and in that article, the author indicated that the issue is not whether or not the work was performed under a contract, but rather whether the liability that results comes about solely because of peculiar contract language that imposes liability beyond what would be imposed by common law in the absence of that language. I believe that's the law the rationale that this Court should adopt.
Counsel, in fact, dealing with the argument of contractual liability, it goes on to say, since the work was performed under a contract, the Court of Appeals appears to be saying that the contractual liability exclusion of the CGL policy automatically applies. And you seem to be arguing that, too. Applying this reasoning to its logical extreme, this is the article from the Insurance Risk Management Institute. Applying that argument to its logical extreme, it would seem that the insurance companies in Wisconsin would not have to pay any claims so long as the claims arise out of work performed pursuant to a contract. If that is indeed the result of this decision, it is a rather unfortunate holding, since it would penalize contractors for entering into written contracts, something that insurance companies consistently encourage and sometimes demand their insurers to do. The Court's reasoning completely misconstrues the purpose of the contractual liability exclusion and goes on. I was quite taken aback that the Insurance Risk Management Institute would be at such odds with the interpretation of the contractual liability in the Court of Appeals opinion, because the final paragraph is even stronger than what I just read. You know,
well,
strong words to follow.
What I'm emphasizing is that you have to focus on the facts of this case where there was an assumption of liability. There was. It wasn't just a breach of contract. It was an assumption of liability by reason of the special warranty.
So my reading of Couch as to what it means in an insurance contract, that provision assuming responsibility, and an Appleman, I have them here someplace, is my reading incorrect or are Couch or Appleman incorrect as to what that assuming responsibility means? Do you know what Couch and Appleman
mean? Yes, I think the way they describe it, I think it's an overly restrictive interpretation of that exclusion.
Pardon?
It's an overly restrictive interpretation of that exclusion.
So contrary to Couch and Appleman and I believe Anderson and Long, which you say they have an overly restrictive interpretation of the exclusion, you would like to make it a little more liberal. Is that correct?
Not liberal. I just want to implement the what I believe is the clear wording, that if it deals with an assumption of liability in a contract.
Aren't the general axioms with regard to insurance contract construction and with regard to exclusions, the general premises, exclusions are to be narrowly construed. I suppose that's why Couch and Appleton and Appleman and Long do it that way. But you don't agree with that. Hmm?
I agree with those general propositions, sure. But I think that for the reasons I've stated, that this exclusion would apply. I just have a short time remaining. I just want to comment, too. I don't believe there's property damage in this case, and that's another clear reason why there's no coverage under the American Family policies, because there's no occurrence. If an occurrence is defined as including property damage during the policy period. And here there was no property damage during the policy period. We had no damage to property, property in the sense that your work caused damage to some other property. And the Pleasant Company had no such damage. They continued to use this building all throughout the American Family policy periods. They had no loss of use throughout the American Family policy periods. And any repair work that had to be done was done by Rentschler under this special warranty. They absorbed the cost during that period of time. Now, I also think that shows you really what the parties had in mind here. For over 2.5 years, American Family was never told about this loss. Rentschler was performing the work under the special warranty, and it only came up as an issue when it was determined that perhaps this whole building had to be torn down, you'd have to start from scratch. Now, this is not the type of thing that commercial general liability coverage was intended to cover. An insurer taking a risk that they might not get it right the first time, do it a second time, and then have the CGL carrier pay that and then spread the risk amongst all the other contractors that might be in that pool of risk, requiring perhaps Rentschler's competitor to share in that business risk. In this case, really what they're advocating is making the insurance company a business partner with Pleasant Company and Rentschler. That's not the intent of CGL coverage. If they wanted to cover themselves, they should have gotten a bond. Commentators have repeatedly stated that CGL coverage is not akin to a bond, and that's really what they're arguing here. And what this whole case is about is attempting to go in through the back door, taking an exception to an exclusion to try to create coverage rather than starting from the beginning with a proper coverage analysis, analyzing occurrence, analyzing accident, analyzing property damage, looking at other exclusions in the policy. The court has to keep in mind that it's a commonly accepted construction rule that you can't play one exclusion against another exclusion. Each exclusion has to be looked at individually. And you can't create coverage by way of an exception to an exclusion. That's what's being attempted here, and the court should reject that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lawring, you have 5 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mike Lawring of Appleton. I represent Ohio Casualty and West American Insurance Companies in this matter. It's been set forth in the briefs, explained that this court has the discretion to affirm the Court of Appeals on alternate grounds from those which the Court of Appeals used. In the short time I have this morning, I'm going to discuss one of those alternate grounds, the known loss doctrine. I think a very brief set of facts makes sense to set a background. March of 95 was when they first discovered settlement of the building, and they admit that this was unusual settlement at that time. Some settlement was expected, but this was called unusual. April 3rd of 1995, the building settlement was measured at 8.5 inches. From 1995 through 1997, Rensselaer had monitored the settlement through a subcontractor, a contractor of Hamburg. As of October 30th of 1995, Rensselaer had already spent almost $13,000 repairing the building because of the settlement and had also put forth its own free work in doing other repairs because of the settlement. Finally, in January or February of 97, there was the meeting between Gordon Rensselaer and the Pleasant Company representatives to discuss the settlement problem. They were of the opinion at that time that the settlement problem needed to be addressed further than these repairs that Rensselaer had been doing. As Mr. Yankala explained, this building was going to settle. They knew that from the get-go. It was a matter of how much. And by February of 97, the answer to that question was too much. All this had taken place before the issuance of the Ohio casualty policies. That is why this was a known loss and not a loss that is covered by insurance. The petitioners make significant concessions in their reply briefs concerning the known loss doctrine. Pleasant Company concedes that the doctrine probably applies to the second Ohio casualty policy and the general casualty policy. It also makes only one argument as to the first Ohio casualty policy, and that is that there was no formal claim made by Pleasant prior to that policy being issued. Rensselaer only makes a specific argument that the known loss doctrine should not preclude the policies post-1995. It doesn't explain in its reply brief why, after that February of 97 meeting, the known loss doctrine should not apply to all of the policies that follow. Rensselaer essentially argues that Wisconsin should adopt a standard similar to the Montrose decision, and that the doctrine of known loss should include a requirement for proof of fraud, should require that legal liability of for the damages should be established to a certainty or a near certainty. Also important is that both petitioners apparently now concede that the known loss doctrine is a separate and distinct doctrine from the continuous trigger theory, and that the known loss doctrine could cut off liability even in a situation, or cut off coverage rather, even in a situation where there was a continuous trigger. The known loss doctrine also already exists in Wisconsin, although there are few cases that discuss it. The point is that the known loss doctrine as it exists in Wisconsin does not require a proof of fraud. It does not require that liability and damages be established to a certainty. Looking at a couple of cases illustrates this. The estate of Logan, the attorney malpractice case, the standard the court discussed there was that when the insured knew that a breach had been committed prior to the issuance of the policy, that there should not be coverage. There's no requirement that a claim had been filed. In fact, one had not. There's no requirement that there had been fraud. That's not even discussed in that case. Simply that the insured knew that a breach had been committed. In our case, Rensselaer clearly knew they had breached their contract. They clearly knew the building was settling more than anyone had anticipated, and that it was a problem that needed remediation.
How would you define the known loss doctrine? You've been arguing about the known loss doctrine. How would you define it?
I would define the known loss doctrine sort of hand-in-hand with the doctrine of fortuity, that insurance is meant to cover fortuitous losses and that they should not be required to cover a loss which was known, and I think under the Wisconsin case is a loss which should have been known by the insured based on an objective standard. The city of Edgerton, I think, also illustrates the objective standard. Although it doesn't reach the issue, it does mention the standard that a loss which the insured knew of or should have known of was the issue there.
Now, in City of Edgerton, you're citing the Court of Appeals decision?
I am citing the Court of Appeals decision, Your Honor. And this has been reversed on other grounds. They did not address the known loss issue when it was reversed. I would also add, I'm sorry, I see my time is up, and therefore I will turn the counsel over.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Kanta?
May it please the Court. I'm Leanne Conta, representing Regent Insurance Company and General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. I'll refer to them as General Casualty collectively here. My client did not issue an insurance policy until April 1st of 1999, 4 years after this building began to sink. As Attorney Lorang points out, the Pleasant Company has conceded this doctrine bars coverage as to my client. In their reply brief, they indicate that by policy year 6, which is General Casualty's policy, Rentschler knew not only that significant and unexpected damage had taken place, but also that Pleasant demanded compensation for such damages. I submit it's telling that the Pleasant Company has never submitted a claim or brought any sort of lawsuit against General Casualty seeking coverage. There was a claim submitted in August of 1997. Damages were discussed. Insurance coverage was discussed. Fault was attributed. That was 2 years, almost 2 years, before my client issued its first policy. In addition to the Pleasant concession, though, we have an undisputed admission by Gordon Rentschler as to his knowledge of the significance of the loss prior to General Casualty's policy period. I deposed Mr. Rentschler. He was the president of Rentschler, and he also happens to be a licensed engineer. In that deposition, I asked him the following question. Is it fair to say, then, that by the summer of 1998, you had no doubt that a significant settlement problem had occurred, and the only question was how to remediate it? Answer, yeah. In the summer of 1998, the settlement continued. It was obvious that it required some corrective action. Yes. We have raised this admission at every level, the trial court level, the court of appeals level, and this level. It has never been refuted. There have only been bald assertions made by Rentschler that the extent of the settlement was unknown, and I submit that is absolutely incorrect by April 1st of 1999 as to my client.
Counselor, do you rely more firmly on the known loss doctrine or your argument that there was no occurrence within the policy period?
As to my client,
yes.
We believe the known loss doctrine is certainly dispositive and is, as Justice Bradley said, that is our best argument, although I believe very strongly that there is no occurrence causing property damage. And just to set forth the Vogel versus Russo matter, Wausau Tile, and Wisconsin Label, all three of those decisions demonstrate the contractual liability is not covered under insurance policies. That is not the purpose of commercial general liability policies. It's for injury to third parties and damage to other property. We do not have that here. All we have is remediation costs. The damage was to the building itself and nothing else. So the third point, though, that I wanted to get back to with respect to the known loss doctrine is really the only point that Rentschler even asserts, and they don't argue any of this vigorously as to General Casualty, is that it advised General Casualty of a possibility of a claim in its policy application. That is absolutely incorrect. And the record site that I direct the court to is record 117, and that's the policy application that was submitted about a month before General Casualty issued its policy. It indicates in that application that all claims are closed and references the Pleasant building, noting it was paid. The suggestion that that application could possibly be an implication that General Casualty intended to provide coverage is absolutely flawed and faulty reasoning.
Counsel, what was it that the trial court found as the date? Was it January?
It was January or February of 1997, which meant that the doctrine precluded coverage as to both Ohio Casualty and General Casualty.
Are we bound by that determination? We, as a reviewing court, bound by that factual determination of the trial court? Or can we pick another date, if there's a date to be selected?
I think essentially it's de novo review, and the court can look at the insurance coverage issues. And so I don't precisely know if the factual determination would be binding. My thought would be that the court would review the record fresh and could determine its date. I certainly think that at the time of General Casualty's policy, there were not only had the loss occurred, insurance coverage was discussed, remediation options were discussed with price tags, the geosyntic options were discussed by all of the parties, and Gordon Rentschler admitted that they wouldn't be discussing insurance coverage back in 97 if a loss had not occurred. By the time my client issued its policy, the building had sunk 17 inches. it would thwart the very nature of insurance coverage, which is to provide against fortuitous losses, unanticipated losses, if the policy provided coverage in the situation where the loss was certain. That concludes my argument.
And Mr. Schwartz and Bart, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, I think as I analyze the arguments that are offered here by the insurers, I think what they're really trying to say is that there's no occurrence here, and that's kind of where I left off in my argument before. I want to offer you four reasons why breach of a contract can be a covered occurrence based upon the language of the policy. I've heard a lot of rhetoric about why it shouldn't be covered, but I haven't heard much reference to policy language. And if there's anything that the recent Johnson Controls case teaches us, is that adherence to policy language is critical. The insuring clause requires showing of two things: property damage caused by an occurrence. Property damage is defined as physical injury to tangible property. We have physical injury to tangible property here. We have structural damage to the building. An occurrence is defined as an accident including continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same conditions causing an unfortunate result. Here's four reasons why you have an occurrence in this case. If you accept the argument that there is no occurrence, number one, it contradicts the plain meaning of clear and simple language in the policy. Number two, it produces absurd and unreasonable results. Number three, it renders the business risk exclusions in this policy meaningless. And lastly, it's contrary to the Court's general rules of construction that doubts as to coverage are construed in favor of the insured and that the policy has to be viewed from the standpoint of the insured's reasonable expectations. Now, property damage, we have property damage in this case. We've got physical injury to tangible property. There's no other adjectives in the definition of property damage that suggest that property damage is limited to third-party property or other property. It simply says property damage. That's all there is to it. There is no adjectival gloss beyond that.
Counsel, if I may interrupt on that point, take a look, as you have, at the Vogel case that was referenced by Ms. Conta. And, of course, that case and makes reference to the important notion that it is damage to property other than the product or completed work, which you were just addressing. Tackle, if you will, the Vogel case, if you can.
That is addressed in the business risk exclusions, Your Honor. That's where the distinction is made between damage to other property and damage to the insured's own work. And the third reason I was going to offer to the Court as to why there's an occurrence is precisely that. Why is there an exclusion in the policy for damage to the insured's own work if the insured's own work is by definition not property damage? If the insured's own work can't be property damage within the definition of the insuring clause, we don't need these business risk exclusions. We don't need an impaired property exclusion. We don't need a sistership exclusion. We don't need an exclusion for damage to your own product, because if you accept the insurer's argument, by definition, that's not property damage. That's my second point, which is this produces absurd and unreasonable results. In the Johnson Controls case, this Court once again cited to an article by Robert Chesler, which had been cited earlier in the General Casualty versus Hills case, where the author makes the point that because liability policies are intended to protect insureds from negligent acts resulting in property damage to third parties, an insured when buying CGL coverage expects that any activity resulting in unintended and unexpected property damage to a third party will be covered unless it's specifically excluded. We've addressed in our brief this shibboleth of there's no coverage for breach of contract damages. I haven't heard any reference to language in the policy that suggests that a breach of contract resulting in damage, tangible physical injury to tangible property, cannot constitute property damage caused by an occurrence. The definition of accident refers to an event, including arising out of the unintended and unexpected negligence of a party producing an unfortunate result. If you buy into the argument that there is no accident, I think as Mr. Laskus said, if the building collapses, that's not an accident, but if there happens to be some personal property that gets hit by the falling debris, like the Twin Towers on 9/11, well, then that's an accident. But if the building went down, there wouldn't be an accident. That's an absurd result.
Counselor, if we buy your argument, isn't every breach of contract unexpected and unintended?
I think unless the contract breach is itself shown to be an intentional act. For example, I think this Court, in dealing with the economic loss doctrine, which I would submit, again, as we did in our briefs, is a red herring, the Court has made distinction between claims for intentional misrepresentation and negligent misrepresentation. And I think there's insurance cases from other jurisdictions which have also made that point, that when there is intentional conduct, intentionally causing results, by definition, the consequences of that are not accidental because the consequences are not unintended and unexpected.
Right, but those are usually cases involving fraud in the inducement or misrepresentation prior to reaching agreement on the contract. What you're telling us is that if there's a breach of contract and it causes damage to any type of property, that it is perforce an accident because it's obviously unexpected and unintended on the part of the person who committed himself or herself to performing the contract.
Your Honor, I think some of the cases discussed in the briefs from other jurisdictions have, in this context, drawn a distinction between contractual claims where the contractor makes a deliberate decision to depart from plans and specifications. Mm-hmm. And they suggest that those cases may not present an accident. But when the allegation is that there was an attempt to do the work, but by negligence or inattention to detail, there was a contractual failure, that those types of claims are accidents.
And they're all from other jurisdictions?
Those cases are from other jurisdictions, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the arguments in this case, very helpful arguments, I may add, and we will take a 5 to 10 minute, a 5 minute recess so that the seats can change and we'll be prepared for the next case. Thank you.